Welcome to Theatre Voice, a podcast all about performance from the V&A Museum. I'm Tim Bano, and I'm your brand new guide for this brand new season, featuring interviews and discussions with all kinds of practitioners from the theatre world. It seems fitting in these strange new times to begin the latest season of Theatre Voice with an ending, and doubly fitting as we isolate and remove ourselves from the throng of community and start to miss being squeezed up against each other in bustling theatres, to feature two people who've done an extraordinary amount to foster community and to bring people together. A week or so ago, the Bunker Theatre in London closed its doors for the last time. Once an underground car park, in 2016, Joshua McTaggart and Joel Fisher converted it into a rough-and-ready performance space, and with successes like Isley Lynn's Skinner Cat, it quickly became a thriving new fringe venue. In September 2018, the Bunker was taken over by artistic director Chris Sonex and executive director David Ralph, who took it to new heights, championing unheard voices and bringing in new audiences. Even before coronavirus forced everywhere else to shut down, the Bunker was due to close this month anyway so that the site could be redeveloped. The emergency shutdown meant that its final season was cut off a week early, but they've made the last six shows available online as a film project called Where Do We Go Next, consisting of short plays from underrepresented writers and exploring the role of political theatre in a hostile environment. You can have a watch at wheredowegonext.squarespace.com. But just before the Bunker closed, critic J.N. Benjamin met artistic director Chris Sonex and executive director David Ralph to talk about the Bunker Theatre.
So let's talk about the Bunker Theatre, because you're in your final season, set of seasons. This takeover period that's been, what, 7 weeks?
Eight weeks.
Yeah. So each week we've had a different artist take over the Bunker space and program basically the entire building. So whatever is happening in the building is an artistic choice.
Yeah.
So for example, when we had Everyone on a couple of weeks ago, there was a crash in the building that
was
happening.
In the writer's snug.
Yeah.
The writer's snug became what it needed to be for that week, which was a crash. And the that was during the matinee performances. So matinee audiences got a different soundtrack to the show, which is sort of both by design and by accident. It was like happy extra flavour to the show.
I also think statistically that we probably had some writers in that snug at that particular time.
Yeah.
With the little people, do you know what I mean? They might turn into writers.
Fantastic understanding of narrative structure.
Yeah.
The developing mind.
It was great. It was lovely. It was one of my favourite things just to have kids around, actually.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I know we don't have that offer a lot for kids, do you know what I mean? So to have them in the building was lovely.
And how did the audience react to that particular sort of addition to the programming?
The thing is that Mark has done it way back when. Marcus Bernard, for the Upsetters, he did the thing with where everything was relaxed completely, which meant you could all bring kids and stuff. When he did that short,
the very first one,
and there was kids in the audience then, right? Not creshed, but there in hand and making noise. And you know what happened after 2 minutes? People just didn't care. I don't think there was any adverse reaction or positive reaction particularly. It was just more of about freedom. So you can come in.
It's also, because there were a couple of people who did kind of go, oh, well, it's really strange that you've put the crash next to the theatre. One, do you think we're hiding rooms? we decided not to put the children in the padded room at the back. We decided to put them right next to the theatre. But also, there's a wonderful shift. When you've decided the artists are running the building, makes things a lot easier from a complaints point of view or a front of house point of view. Just go, yes, that's the artistic decision. That is part of the show that you have paid to see, is this particular configuration of the building and this particular attitude towards audiences and that audience artist relationship. It's been fun to kind of do eight different versions of that relationship.
Mm.
I've spoken loads about Everyone, and I feel like we have to shout out the other ones. So can we talk? So last week we had Natasha Brown with I Am Not Kanye West. And who else have we had?
We talked about the Upsetters.
We've had the Upsetters. We've had Debbie Hannon and Vinnie Heaven doing Queers Up Front, which was phenomenal. As a space of like people actually coming in and going, you know, secretly to Debbie, oh, I've just come out as queer, or I'm transitioning but nobody knows, you know, and that sort of like, and I feel comfortable. And also you just see people's body language of feeling accepted. And also that, I think that's it's an ethos thing, because it's not like we've massively shouted about the fact that our programme is also inclusive of queer voices, right? Which it is, but it's not like we shouted about it. It's just it's an ethos of a building to say, you're welcome. It doesn't matter what colour, creed, race, gender, sexuality you are. Just you're welcome, because you're a person in the building. And we like people in the audience. That's nice. I have a slight egotism, or I surround myself so that I can have this slight egotism, is that I can fix most problems with a play. like that's easy enough to do. If the dramaturgically needs some work, it's either going to be me that's looking at it and working really closely with the writer, or Debbie, or even sometimes David when I haven't been here. Actually, he's given some notes directorially. So like, that's not the main concern. The main concern is, can we fix the world? Do you know what I mean? Like, can we do that? Can we make people feel a little bit less shit? And also, I think when you're talking about people having shared experiences, that is true, and that's really lovely. But also, there is there's a world where, well, at least I hope that this is the case, is that we don't have to say anything. So I don't experience child loss in a way that a woman would suffer child loss. I'm not mum, right? So I don't have to say anything. Like, I'm not gonna sit there and mansplain shit to you. So I just shut up. And I listen, right? And that's what happens all the time, I think, with our people. If we don't, our staff and our associates, is if we don't have a direct correlation to that, then that's okay. But we will learn from it, and we won't start to explain stuff that we don't understand. We don't have to have an opinion just to have an opinion's sake. Do you know what I mean? So that's the most important thing, I think.
It's one of the great things about giving the artists the space. Sabrina Mahfouz, another week, this week, it's currently getting in.
You can probably hear that in the background.
Almost certainly. Two pieces, one about a couple grieving over their stillborn daughter several years later, another one about abortion rights debate specific to the UK rather than the US debate that we talk about a lot. Sabrina came in and said, the one thing that's really important to me to do this week is that we have some sort of counsellor who's going to be in the space who can be available to people. So we said yes, and we worked out how to do it. And that ability to kind of go yes and figure out the details, rather than going, no, you're coming into our theatre and this is how we do these things and this is how we do these things, is a really exciting thing to be.
But also, everything that's flexible in theatre should be flexible in many, many different ways. It's like, we're told that we have to strive for perfection, but perfection is a very specific box that people have decided that is perfection, right? So it goes from the tiny little things. So, oh, I want this playlist playing in the bar. Like, that's a really simple thing to do. I know it's like, people do that, but like, it's a really simple thing to do. I want the seats to look like this, or I want to do this, and we go, yes, let's see how we can make it. And also, we're really saying also is that you don't have to, it doesn't have to be in that little box of perfection, is to say that, for instance, if you look at something like Abraham Adeyemi's All the Shit, that because we got into a situation where we had to say we can't give this the best way that we can give it, but we will give you something, and that's okay. And also the stuff that Abraham learned as a writer through that was really, really incredibly important. So yes, did it fit into a box of perfection? No. Did the actor have the script in hand? Yes. Was it a different actor every night? Yes. Was it brilliant? Yes. Was it perfect? Probably not. I don't care.
I think that's something super interesting as well when we think about measures of success and impact measurement and all of that sort of stuff. For me, I think one of the things that makes Bunker so successful is, instead of thinking about the seven boxes that already exist and trying to squeeze into them in order to make your space successful according to, I don't even know who came up with those measures of success. Mm. You more take an holistic approach to that. So this whole thing of saying, well, that wasn't possible, so we can't meet those measures of success, but let's think about what we can do to still give you something. I think David and I was talking about that the other day, and saying, you know, impact measurement, and I think, yeah, impact measurement in the industry sort of needs a bit of an overhaul, and perhaps that's why there are so few spaces like the Bunker that exists that are operational and that are being successful. But even the idea of saying being successful seems weird, because you're not, what does success mean, right?
Yeah, but we have to really look at what that means success-wise, because I understand what it means in a capitalist society, but theatre doesn't really fit into a capitalist society, because it always consistently loses money. Even the hits in the West End consistently lose money, you know what I mean? So, like, do we fit into a capitalist society? No, not really, but we still need the money, right? So, like, we still need to keep doing it. I don't think success should be about how much money we make and how many people are in the audience also. Because in the same way that there was a night with Queers Up Front where there was only 12 people in the audience, right? But in that moment of 12 people being in the audience, somebody that was an older gentleman who had a very specific view changed his view in the process of around trans rights. Changed his view in the process of the evening. There was also somebody there that saddled up again to Debbie and said, I've just come out and, like, I feel
there you
feel
are finished, saving, you know, the world one play at
a time. Yeah, but there's 12 people in that audience. So if we discount the fact that there's 12 people in the audience and we go, well, that was a failure then, wasn't it? No, not at all, because there's two people there that his life have been, yeah, just changed somewhat, right? Do you know what I mean? I know it sounds really, again, that sounds really wanky, but, like, the one person in the audience, if you can change that, then it's great. Like, if they change, if they move, if they do something, or if the artist changes and moves in that moment, then that's success, isn't it? Like, the sales sold out houses in the awards, they don't really mean much to me. There's moments in places where, like, say for instance Little Miss Burden, I'm incredibly proud for that show and for Matilda and everybody involved. But one of the successes of that show for me was on press night, when there's a moment in the play where they say, oh, plantain, and that's how you say plantain, right? And then somebody in the audience went, it's plantain, yeah, right? Now the thing is, right,
it's not, by the way.
But what's really brilliant about that is that somebody had the agency to do that, right? And that's my success to that. That's one of the most brilliant successes in that. And that was press night, and that was brilliant. So, which ordinarily press night is quite stuffy, and you know, but no, this person had the agency to do that. That is a success. Can I put that on an Arts Council form? Probably not. Right.
David and I, we were talking about the concept of accountability and what that means and how that differs. In fact, first of all, I think we should talk about your role as an executive director. So what is the role of an executive director?
The executive director role broadly is running the business side of a theatre building. The irony there is that what Chris says is true. Theatre does not normally function, except in some quite specific situations which make a huge amount of money, in a capitalist framework. And in fact, the government do a lot of things to recognise that. They create the Arts Council hundreds of years ago. They then, you know, allocate certain amounts of funding towards it. They create this tax relief to recognise the ways in which this doesn't function, but it's still desired. My role is about making Chris's vision and the artistic vision of the theatre work, scrape to even, and make sure that everyone gets paid. The way that it's a little bit different in the Bunker is twofold. One is just purely by the nature of us being a very small company. I am more present in the building because I sometimes am on front of house. I'm sometimes turning on lights and you know, welcoming companies into the space, welcoming audiences into the space, as is Chris, as is every other member of our, you know, small team. The other one's a bit more structural. Normally an executive director and an artistic director, in some way, shape or form, one of them's a CEO or the other one's a CEO or they're joint chiefs, are reporting to a board of trustees or a board of you know, whatever the charitable structure is. The Bunker is not a charity, and therefore we don't have that governance. And so my role as an executive director on the board of a CIC, essentially one of two people that can make a series of decisions, means that we can move really, really quickly without that long-term steering and governance. That's suited us down to the ground because we are closing this theatre, and we've known for quite a while that the bunker didn't have a sort of a really long shelf life. So we didn't change that structure. Long term, you have to change that structure. It's unsustainable. But what it's meant is that in a short period of time, we've made a bunch of really exciting decisions, some of them financially more risky than any board of anything would sign off on. But we've been able to move very agilely in that space, which has been really rewarding, really exciting. It's meant that we've been able to try a load of different things out. There's been no point at which I haven't been thinking about the bottom line. We don't have enough money not to. So you end up making a set of really interesting decisions. And so that's been really exciting. That's, I guess, the weird thing about me as a ED. But apart from that, it is the normal structure, just in a really small building that had nothing to lose.
It feels like... correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like you're saying that because there was no one holding you accountable, that you were able to make the decisions that you made that made the theatre what it is. Which sort of raises questions about how slowly a lot of the rest of the industry or a lot of other buildings within the industry are moving in terms of becoming more inclusive, for want of a better term. So in terms of, so if you have, because you don't have anybody to answer to, you can say...
What I would say is we do have, we do have accountability to our staff, to our artists and to our audiences, and ultimately, that's true of any theatre building, any theatre production company. They ultimately are going to be the people that they're accountable to. What we didn't have was the intermediary step of the sort of check and balance of the system, which, you know, I'm not going to militate against. I've just joined a charity that obviously has a board of trustees, and I'm actually really looking forward to working in that structure, but I'm hoping that there's something about that tight relationship between an audience and the work, between the company and its team and its artists, that I can take forward, because I think it's valuable. I think it's really, really helpful to be that closely linked in with the way people are responding to the work, the way people are responding to through ticket sales, through turning up, through every single other metric that you're looking at. Because what we've seen is that when we've programmed for a bunch of different audiences and programmed a bunch of artists who are going to bring different audiences through the building, they've shown up, they've bought tickets, they've spent money at the bar. We've seen that, you know, and specifically we've seen that with black audiences in a way that I think lots of theatres are really sceptical of. And I think we've made this, bizarrely, we've made a quite capitalist case for programming black work.
Well, I think if you look at, we're talking about the other theatres not necessarily working as quick as we can, and it's something, this is me not advocating or defending the National, but they have so many people, it's a massive ship that takes time to turn, like in the same way that government is, you know, what they say is that you don't see really policy after till about 4 years later, in which case then there might be a new government. Right, which is, it is a weird thing, but that's
then
the same.
They change the rule again.
Yeah, and then they change the rule again, right? But the National is such a big entity that it takes some time for that to change. However, you have to really, really give a shit, you know? Like, you have to care about these things. The reason that that we have the programme and that we have is because that is my lived experience, and that is the people that I know, and that's the people that I grew up with, right? And sometimes, because I'm obsessed with and to celebrate the difference of people, right, be that whether it's race or whatever, right, is that I didn't necessarily grow up with disabled black women, right, but there's a story, and we talk about story, and we're interested by that story, and I think, and it's a great thing to platform. So, and because I'm obsessed now with other people's stories and stuff like that, I care, right? And because women are women have been so instrumental into my life, right, in so many different ways, I love what they have to say, right? So I decided that the majority of the programming would be women, but not because of their gender necessarily, but because they were writing better work. But because I did that, because I said, oh, because we did a whole season of female voices and didn't shout about it, and because the second season was almost exclusively female voices as well, and nobody picked that up. What happens is there's a knock-on effect where women want to send plays to me, right, and want to put their show on in the bunker. Now, if the optics are that other theatres are not platforming female voices, then they say, well, we're not getting those female voices. There's a truth in there somewhere, right? But it's because they're not doing it that they're not getting the voices. So you have to change something straight away from the top, and then it will filter down. So let's program more female voices, and then more female voices will come to you, right? This is what we've seen with the bunker.
Mm.
I have a very minority of men that actually, I still get white, middle class men. I haven't got anything necessarily against them, but I still get them sending me scripts. But I don't get as many. And I do get lots more people of colour. I do get lots more working class voices. I do get lots more female voices.
Mm. So you guys have been here for how long has the bunker been alive?
October 2016.
Okay, so like for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
And you've been here since inception?
No.
Oh.
No. I joined about 9 months in as general manager.
Okay.
At the point where one of the founding directors was stepping away to go and run the Actors' Centre.
Mm.
About a year after that, Josh McTaggart stepped away to run the Chelsea Theatre. So I've been, ED for coming up on 2 years.
And Chris, how long have you been here?
What's that? September 2018.
Yeah, so a year and a half.
Year and a half. Jesus, feels like forever.
I want to ask you about what you're most proud of in your tenure as artistic director here. And maybe what you're most proud of is different, but I'd like to hear that from you too.
There's a lot to be proud of, and it's mostly to do with the artists and the people that have entered the building. I think that what I am most proud of is that because of their talent and because of their brilliance, we have proven that it is sustainable, and that we should be much more representative in our industry, because people do turn up to it. And I think that getting recognised for awards is great and lovely for your ego, but for my soul and for my morality, knowing that we did the best that we could do with so many underrepresented voices is the thing that makes me sleep at night. Mm. You know, and giving people their first shows or the shows that they really wanted to do, and making them the best possible shows as well, with all of our input and I was shocked actually when I got here where people were saying to me, oh, you're going to give me some dramaturgical advice, or you're going to give me some notes on directing, because they'd worked in other Fringe rooms, and you're like, what is that? I didn't know that wasn't a given. I thought that was the thing that you were meant to do. I've been doing that since I've started at the court, so I didn't know that was a given, but we pushed and helped those artists achieve what they needed to achieve. And also even the really established ones, so like Anna Jordan, I mean, we Anchor and Hope has been her love for the lot since she wrote it, and it never went on, you know. So that was nice to have that, and so was, you know, to Rachel Delahaye's My White Best Friends, and that was really lovely to be part of that reimagining of that process, and then to have that really like bang in, you know, 2 weeks. But then you've got also the Ellie Tindall and her first play, like that gets 5 stars on the stage, like amazing news for her, like, you know, amazing. And all of that work. So it's always been about the artists, I guess, that I'm proud of. I'm proud for them. I'm not proud of them, because I feel like if I say I'm proud of them, that means that I'm taking some of their credit. But, like, I'm proud for them.
David, do you echo that? Do you have anything else to add?
I used to joke that the thing that I was most proud of was setting up the Bunker Workplace Pension Scheme, which I sort of still am. There are a load of things that were about making this company sort of fit for purpose and professionalising it to the point where we could do exciting things. And I still think that that's true. But one of the really interesting things is seeing the gradual shift from people being excited about individual projects to just being excited about the building and the team and being excited to hear what we're going to do next, which is obviously sad because we're not going to be doing anything next as the bunker. But it's really interesting to see. You have to have a series of shows that connect with people before you can start building up that kind of reputation as a building. That first sort of flush of excitement fades really quickly. And so for me, when people go, oh, the bunker's doing really exciting things, knowing that that actually has a long tail to it, and has a has meant that there has been a series of things that have had impact on people, and have resonated with people, and that they've shown up for, is really exciting.
It makes me think about the point, I don't remember which one of you it was made earlier before we started recording, which is about audience development versus artist development. Which I think is a really interesting dichotomy, and it also speaks to the concept of being kind of anti-capitalist and theatre as an anti-capitalist entity. And I wonder if one of you could say more on this concept of don't worry about the audiences, actually, because if you develop the artist and if that's where you put your investment, then the audiences will just come.
Yeah, I mean, it is, if you build it, they will come, I guess. Not all the time, though.
It's a luxury in a weird way. It's a luxury that we've had to be able to go, we're going to focus on the artists because we don't know that we're going to be around long enough to develop an audience for ourselves. But what happens when you focus in on the very core of it, the very core product, the minimum viable product, is tonight a show goes on. And you have to be really proud about that regardless of who's in the audience, and find some kind of connection there. That ultimately, I think they do come hand in hand. But if audience follow artist, as opposed to trying to program the other way around, you find some really
exciting
things happen.
Well, you don't become a taste setter, do you? If you start going, oh, this is what an audience like.
Yeah.
So you can't. Do you know what I mean? You can't change fashion just making white shirts.
It's like your thing about you never want to program the Trump play Trump,
yeah.
Right? If you're already noticing a trend,
then it's too late.
It's too late. Mm. So and given that no one's a magician, no one's a fortune teller, what you have to do is just believe in the people, the artists, to be the people who are going to capture the next thing, that are already they're already there, thinking about the thing that is going to capture people's attention.
And sometimes you do things and it doesn't pay off. You with when it comes down to audiences, it's like I noticed a massive thing. We talk about working class a lot. There's a lot of talk about that, but when I programmed two very very important pieces of work about working class voices, was there a massive audience for it? No, to the point of the fact that I really wanted to go in on loads of people and be like, you were talking forever about the fact there's no working class voices, but you didn't turn up. So what are you saying? It means your working class voice has not been platformed. Is that what you're saying? Because you're not coming out to support your fellow people. Mm. Right? And that's really, really disappointing to see, especially because both of those plays, not to say that they did badly, they didn't, but they could have done much better, right? And it's infuriating because both of those pieces are phenomenal. And they don't talk down to the audience. They just assume that you know the struggles, right? And you didn't turn up for it. And that's interesting, isn't it? but then when you do something like This Is Black, or if you do Funeral Flowers, the black community come and show up for their artists. And I'm incredibly blown away from that support, you know. But the working classes, or the people that talk about them being working class, didn't necessarily turn up, right? And that's interesting. But we have to build an audience for that then.
Yeah.
So because by the time We Anchor came around, there was much more of a working class audience in that show coming to see it. But yes, I care mostly about the audiences, and also remember the artists' audience.
Yeah.
Just people don't seem to realise. And actually, when we talk about the bubble, there is a bubble. There's a massive bubble, right? Of artists coming to watch art to get better at their art, to make art so artists can come and see art. Do you know what I mean? Like the normal everyday people, do they come to theatre if they're not involved in theatre? Yes, they do. Of course they do. But like, not as much as artists do. Artists are consistently in the audience, and that's okay too. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But so you know that you will get artists in an audience as well.
Mm.
So if you show that you're and you believe that you are a haven for artists, then they will also show up. They're not two separate things.
Yeah, that makes sense. Actually, I want to. This is probably a hard one, but I want to ask if you both feel like you've done everything you set out to do when you were given the helm of this place and knew that it wasn't going to last forever?
No. Mm. I haven't. I still have many a play that I would want to put on. many a play that deal with really interesting things that are not being talked about, and from demographics that are not necessarily getting... are not in vogue. You know,
like what?
Just, well, it's I had this whole thing about queerness. It's an interesting thing, and actually now we're lucky because the High Table and the Bush and Tash's show were brilliant. But black queerness or non-white queerness, female queerness also were I'd never saw those shows. I'm going to say underrepresented. I see a lot of middle class white male gay plays. I get a lot of those in the plays, but what about this demographic, or what about in Queers Up Front? We had an incredible Singaporean queer story about him being Muslim. And that is a fucking story.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that is a fucking story, and that I want to be part of pushing those stories. So I haven't achieved that, and never will, I don't think, because there'll always be a new story that I would want to put up. What I think I have achieved is when I first came here, is that I knew that I had to give enough infrastructure and support to the artists and the staff that their next step would be better. And luckily for me, everybody in our staff has stepped up to a better job now. Which is great.
As in after the end?
At the end of the bunker.
It's really sad. I'm making a sad face.
but they've all stepped up, which is not sad.
Mm.
It's a happy face. They've all gone to the next step in their career. All of the artists, whether that be being put on a writer's group or whether they have got a show up somewhere else, have been stepped up. And that's not just the writers or the directors, that's also sound designers and production designers and production managers and all of that stuff. So in a way, that was always my main concern. The next step here, I always thought, should be the Royal Court or the Bush, right? Or something similar. And it has been that. So, yes and no, I have achieved, but haven't achieved everything. But I have achieved that main goal.
Well, 18 months isn't that long. David, you've been here slightly longer, apart from the bunker staff pension scheme. I think it's a really brilliant idea, actually. Tell me, have you set out and done everything you thought you were going to do, you wanted to do?
Yeah, I think actually, from my perspective, there's a really great narrative, which is we expanded, we grew, we were able to give a huge amount to artists. We didn't get all the way there, you know, but we got a hell of a long way from being a pure receiving house, where we sometimes occasionally did co-productions that we called in-house productions, to being almost an entirely co-producing house with our own in-house work that genuinely was us taking a risk on work that we thought was so important that it couldn't not be on our stage. So that shift over such a short period of time, I'm extraordinarily proud of. And in terms of us closing out, we left every penny on the stage. It's not going anywhere else.
Mm.
That's why we're not. We weren't saving up for a rainy day. That's why we're not going onto another space, because we made the call a year ago before we knew the exact date. We knew we weren't going to be going forward unless a miracle happened. We knew we were going to leave every penny on the stage and commit it to the artists rather than to the future of the bunker. And I stand by that decision.
I think I'm not alone in thinking that the Bunker Theatre will be sorely missed. It's been, I was going to say it's been an institution, but maybe you don't even want to be an institution, you know?
Doing all of this institution.
Like, anti-capitalist chat and all of that sort of stuff, but it has made an incredible...
Just to be clear, I love capitalism, I love money, so if you could give me money, anybody, money, consistently.
Yeah. But guys, it's been great talking to you two. It's been great to be able to come to the Bunker. It's been great to see lots of those people go on and do really incredible things afterwards. I'm really sad it's going. I'm sure there are lots of other people who will join me in the sadness. Thank you very much for chatting to me today. This has been Theatre Voice.
Whoop, whoop.
J.N. Benjamin was talking to Chris Sonex and David Ralph. The producers were Tim Bano and Helen Gush. Theatre Voice is an audio archive of conversations about British theatre from the V&A Museum. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit theatrevoice.com to listen to hundreds of interviews with leading theatre makers. Thanks for listening.